WFM. With Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Thanks to Jenny Green. It's Tuesday, the 24th of August, and this is Game On. Coming up today, Fergal Brennan rounds up the return of European football, including the future for Ronaldo at Juventus.
Ora l'idea per Morata, attenzione, si può allargare verso Ronaldo, dentro l'area di rigore, va Cristiano, Ronaldo! La Juventus è in vantaggio! Minuto numero 38, cambia il parziale all'Allianz Stadium, Juventus 1, Cagliari 0.
I understood all of that, Marie, did you?
All of it.
Every last one of it. Well, anyway, a former world-class rider who is now becoming a top trainer, that is Johnny Murtagh, will be with us after his latest big winner.
Final furlong, Alan Knapp running on with on the far side Shanro. Great battle on the near side though. Sonny Boy Liston is delivering a knockout blow and is just in front, and Sonny Boy Liston is going to win the Ebor narrowly from Quickthorn.
Plus we'll hear from Tokyo as the opening ceremony launches a hopeful Paralympics for Team Ireland. And Guardian women's football writer Susie Rock will speak to us about the dangers facing female athletes in Afghanistan.
Game on 2FM.
You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. So, Marie, the Tokyo 2020 Paralympic Games, I keep getting confused every time I say 2020 and 2021, had the opening ceremony today, and the Irish team were the third of the competing nations to be introduced. Brittany Ardenze, who's a powerlifter, and Jordan Lee, an athlete, carried the Irish flag. I know you were at the 2012 version even.
You're getting all the dates wrong today, Ruby. Yeah, I was there in...
You know, when you start with a mistake, they kind of tend to continue.
Yeah, so you're off to a bad start. But yes, I was there in 2012 in London. I went over for a couple of days. I was working for the Sunday Independent and I got to see quite a lot of it, actually. It was brilliant. And at the time, Michael McKillop and Jason Smith were the big stars, and actually they're still the big stars now. So that will just show you how much longevity those two guys have. They've been fantastic athletes. They were really just getting going, I guess, when I was there in 2012, because they added a couple more Olympic Games after that. But it was just brilliant to see. I mean, it's every bit as colourful and dramatic and exciting as an Olympic Games, but just maybe a little bit more accessible to the athletes rather than when you go to an Olympics. But brilliant. And we've a really, really big Irish team there as well. So many stars coming through. Actually, some of them are going to be in action already later on tonight at 1 a.m. We have three in the pool: Barry McClements, Roisin Nurian and Nicole Turner. We had Nicole on actually a little while back. And then in table tennis from 1 a.m. as well, Colin and Judge will be out. So the RTE player is going to cover a huge amount of that as well, and there's going to be a lot of it on RTE television during the day, and a highlight show presented by Ivan Nicquillin every night as well. So for anyone who has been missing their Olympics fix, there's going to be a lot of action there for people to get stuck into.
It sounds like it'll be kind of hectic, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I like anyone that goes to any of these major tournaments, it is a lot. And I think especially when you're trying to deal with a different time zone as well, it can be quite difficult to stay on top of everything. But it's like anything, Ruby, when you sit down and you give it a little bit of time, you get sucked into it pretty quickly, and it'll be on for a couple of weeks as well. And we'll have so many Irish involved and so many Irish medal hopes, and not just the two that I mentioned a little bit earlier as well. So lots of...
No doubt, as athletes, and that's all any of them ever want to be seen as, is just athletes. But for you to go to London and watch them, did you find them inspirational?
Absolutely, yeah. Like, I think maybe the pool was probably the one that really kind of hit home, just how far they have to go just to be able to get into the pool and swim. Like, we had Joanna Reardon on here on Friday, and she was talking us through the different classifications for the athletes. And, you know, some of those people in the pool, they don't have limbs, so you're seeing them, and they're like Ellen Keane would be one that we all know. And, you know, she's missing some of her arm, and she's just absolutely fantastic. And to see what she has to go through just to get through that pool, like when you compare it to able-bodied people, it's phenomenal. And they put in just as much work. They train out in the aquatic centre, they do everything that Olympians would do. And I think, in fairness now, when you think of, maybe when I look back to 2012 to here, I think the recognition is definitely improving, that they are getting quite a lot of airtime. We're seeing it on the telly now, we're going to be seeing it over the last while, but just in terms of the rewards that they get, they really are. And actually, Ruby, went back in 2012, they weren't getting the same grants. think a change maybe around then, where they were getting the same grants as able-bodied athletes. So now that they're able to access the podium grants when they do well and get their medals. So they had to work hard for equality, but they're definitely starting to get it anyway.
You said that they have to work as hard as able-bodied athletes. To me, they have to work even harder. If you think about it, like, you're talking about swimmers with no limbs swimming down a pool. I mean, the absolute core physical strength that you require to do that is phenomenal. If you rationalise it and think about it, how strong they must be physically to do what they're doing. It's outstanding.
Yeah, it really is phenomenal. And even just, I guess, to have the opportunity to do that, because that's something I think that maybe we all take for granted, that you don't have the opportunities. They don't have the opportunities just to go out and get into a swimming pool or go and join a club. Like, it's a lot harder for them. And we've had so many of them on now over the last couple of years, and a lot of them come through different talent identification days as well. And that's how they get into sport, that they will go to the Institute of Sport and they'll be allowed to try loads of different activities and sports and get picked. So they don't have the opportunities that we would have to go and just join whatever club they want. So they have to overcome a huge amount of obstacles as well just to be able to partake. So definitely inspirational, and I'm looking forward to watching it.
I know, because I can, even whilst it's absolutely in no way related, can remember trying to cope with different things whilst being injured. Being on crutches or being without an arm or without a leg or whatever, and how difficult I found just normal things, getting a cup of coffee from the kitchen to the sofa, simple things like that. And then you look at these people and how inspirational they are by getting to an Olympic Games, and we look at all the people in the world that are whinging and moaning about trivial things in their life. I think most people should tune in and watch a little bit of this just to see how well they are going.
Yeah, the attitude, Ruby. I interviewed Mark Rowan years ago now, and he's going to be part of the Olympic coverage doing analysis on RTÉ over the next while. And he was an aspiring Gaelic footballer, ended up in a crash and in a wheelchair, and started racing after that. And I met him when he was building his house, and he was telling me how he had to change everything in the house and just to get his own independence back. But he never sounded like he was complaining about it, you know. It was just pure determination to go out and succeed at whatever he was going to do, and that really shines through, I think, as well when you're watching the Paralympics.
It surely does. Dealt a bad hand, but playing it like it's all aces.
Yep, so a little bit earlier, Siobhan Madigan, who is in Tokyo, spoke to the Paralympics Ireland CEO, Miriam Malone, on her hopes for Ireland at the Games. Let's hear from her.
We've got a superb team. We've got 9 different sports, so a great range of athletes, from seasoned athletes who've been to Paralympic Games before and some new ones and new sports in, which is great to see. Medal target-wise, we are targeting 6 to 10 medals for this Games.
That's up there with Rio. Now, we have to factor in conditions into that too, though.
We do. There are lots of factors, and for this particular Games, you'll be very aware that for the last year and a half, there hasn't been international competition, and there hasn't been even training. The athletes were very, they were excellent with coming up with novel ideas on how to train while at home. Mm. So it hasn't been the ideal lead-in, but everybody has made the best of that situation. So we're still hoping that we get good medal targets, because we've got a very strong athletes and strong team there. So they all have different targets. They'll all be hoping for their personal bests.
We have some rock star athletes too. We have Jason, we have McKillop, we have Ellen Keane. I'm sure you're hoping that they will be leading by example.
Yes, of course. You know, they've been super. They've been tremendous athletes for the last number of years. We're so lucky to have had athletes like Jason, Michael, Katie George and Eve, Niamh McCarthy, and they have done really excellently on the world stage up to now. So hopefully they'll be able to continue that positive form, and hopefully we'll also see some newer athletes coming through also.
Farm's new cooked chicken breast fillets are 100% natural and packed with protein. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now it is time to turn our attention to European football. We'll be chatting to Fergal Brennan very, very shortly. But first, let's have a listen to Shamrock Rovers boss Stephen Bradley talking to Tony O'Donoghue about the deficit that his side have to overturn on Thursday when they face Flora Tallinn.
Yeah, we just got to focus on what we do. Don't worry about how many goals or what we need to do or what time. Just focus on our jobs. Focus on getting back to our levels. And we know if we do that, we can cause this team any team problems. So that's the main focus, get back to our levels and focus on what we do.
The game against Slovan Bratislava, you started that game with two terrific goals. I mean, that must be the template for Thursday night.
Yeah, but you don't, it's obviously that would be an ideal scenario, but you don't know what the game is going to throw up on Thursday. And like I said, it really is about focusing on what we do, focusing on our jobs, trust what we do, and get back to our levels, because this team have been fantastic for a long, long period of time, both domestically and in Europe. And last Thursday we had an off night, and we got punished, and rightly so. We have to take that in the chin, we have to learn from it. We got to make sure we're better for our going forward.
Yeah, big night for Rovers on Thursday night. But Fergal Brennan is with us to discuss everything that happened across Europe last weekend. I think we'll go to League One for what can only be described as a shameful night between Marseille and Nice.
Yeah, disappointing scenes to kind of put it mildly. There's been a number of incidents over the last season, going back to the season previously, with fans at Ligue 1 games. The staggering return of fans in France has been a bit quicker than the UK and Spain and other places within European football. And it wasn't nice. Really, really horrible scenes. About 15 minutes to go, Nice were winning 1-0. And there'd been issues during the game. These are big rivals, Nice and Marseille, and the fans from the home fans, the Nice fans, throwing bottles, throwing missiles, anything they could get their hands on at the Marseille players. Dimitri Payet, everyone remember, obviously played for West Ham, French international, he's a key man for Marseille, and he was particularly targeted. And the kind of switch point of all of this was he's gone over to take a corner and someone has thrown a bottle full of liquid, full pelt at him, and it's hit him on the kind of the back of the neck, and that's just kicked off absolute chaos. He's actually thrown it back into the crowd. There's been more missiles that have come down. Other players have got involved, and then the area of the ground that it was happening on, the security just, there wasn't enough in place, and fans have essentially just ran onto the pitch, and there's just carnage. There was a picture on the front of L'Equipe, the French newspaper, of a fan kicking Payet, which is just absolute madness. And it just rolled on and rolled on, and we had one of those situations where people are following it on Twitter to see whether it would start again or not, and it was never going to restart. Marseille and their manager Jorge Sampaoli essentially said, no, you know, the safety of my players is the most important thing, this is an absolute disgrace, X, Y and Z. One of those strange things where they have to go through protocol. The game did restart from that corner and it just got tipped in. The referee blew his whistle and that was it. And they've been awarded a walk over Nice because they were winning. Marseille have said that they're going to appeal against the result and the situation, because Sampaoli himself did also get involved. He's quite an aggressive character himself, even though he's only a little fella. But just a shameful night from the fans. Obviously, we're seeing so many positive stories of fans returning to stadiums, and then we see examples of this, and it's just not what you want to see.
That's it, Fergal, really, isn't it? It's not what you want to see. And when you think as well that it wasn't that long ago when there was no fans in stadiums, and we were talking about the issues of online abuse and how much players were being targeted on that platform, and then you go back into stadiums, fans who haven't been there for so long, and okay, we're not talking about online abuse, but we are talking about abuse of a different kind at the players again.
Yeah, of course. And I think the danger of these types of situations can't be undersold. The example of Payet, what was being thrown at him, this wasn't a piece of paper. This was a bottle full of liquid that could have caused a really serious injury. You're in a situation where you've got dozens, maybe even up to 100 fans on the pitch, grabbing the players, attacking the players potentially. There was very, very little stewards. There was virtually no police at that end of the ground. It's very, very dangerous. It looks in these types of situations as if it all kind of flares up and then eases down. But it's very, very easy for this to get incredibly serious, someone to get very, very badly injured. I think this was actually a very, very nasty incident. But I think more importantly, it was a close call of what could have happened. And Ligue 1 needs to get their act together. Obviously, with the situation with Lionel Messi going to Paris Saint-Germain, there's going to be huge eyes on the league, on French football this season. And this is a really, really poor way to start things off.
Fergal, we're used to those accusations about loutish fans being thrown at the English Premier League and at the English international team. It's happening now in Ligue 1. Why is it soccer and so much soccer and not as much in other sports?
I think there's a wider question to kind of address there. I think for so long, aspects of it has been accepted. And I think particularly, you mentioned there, obviously, the England national team. you know, to the extent of extreme violence, no, that's not justified by the majority of fans. But there's so many other types of behaviours that go on that eventually just kind of lead to a knock on and a knock on, and then you have a situation of a lot of violence and aggression. I think that has happened. I think there's been a lack of authority from the FAs in France, in England, the leagues, etc. And they've essentially allowed fans too much ability to police themselves and these types of minorities to start to dominate the conversation and create these really ugly scenes. And I think that is part of the situation. I think the England national team is a brilliant example. So many minor unacceptable behaviours have been let go that then builds and builds and enables fans that want to go to games, cause trouble, be violent and dominate things in that regard.
But when you look at it, you said there was no police at that end of the ground and very little stewards. But when you look at the money that's in soccer, you look at the wages they're able to pay, how much FIFA is worth, UEFA is worth, is the onus not completely on them to regulate it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, a lot of what this comes down to is the money in terms of it coming down to the clubs and trickling and trickling and trickling. We look at a situation with stadium security, and this is the case in the Premier League, it's the case in most major leagues right the way across Europe. You've got security staff that are on minimum wage or maybe a little bit more, and generally they're understaffed. I was speaking to somebody that works for a Premier League club earlier this week, and they said that when they make a plan for a match, they are going for the thinnest margin of the amount of staff. They're going with the amount of people that it's legally okay for them to get away with. And I think that's what it comes down to. Clubs themselves have looked at this and thought, I don't want to spend any more money on that because that eats into our profit margins. And ultimately, by and large, that's what they're concerned with. And then that goes then up the ladder to individual FAs, UEFA and FIFA. They'll look to hit the legal requirements of what they need in place, stewards, security, police, etc. But they won't do any more. But clubs won't do any more until they're told to do more, and the powers that be won't do any more until it's in their interest to do so, which is a sad kind of reality, but that is the situation that we find ourselves in.
I'm due to bring my kids to PSG and Lille at the end of October, and watching that, I was a little bit apprehensive about it, but I guess when it comes to a game like that, you'd hope that they will be on top of everything, especially with Messi playing. But the question I have for you, Fergal, is will Mbappe still be playing for PSG, do you think, by then? There is a huge amount of speculation now that he is going to be going to Liverpool.
There is, and obviously, as you say, you're going to watch it, and there's going to be so many fans either going to Paris to watch games or watching PSG on television, and it will just be a kind of a selection of these star players. My hunch in this situation, and it applies to other major transfers that are being kicked around at the moment, we're incredibly short of time. These huge transfers, we're probably talking in excess of 100 million euro, take a lot of building, it takes a lot of paperwork, a lot of talks. We are just over a week out from the transfer window closing. And the interesting thing with PSG, you look at them and you think, how are they getting away with this in terms of FFP? How are they able to finance these deals and pay Messi's wages and Mbappe and Neymar, etc.? They can. My hunch, as it is, Liverpool have been linked, Real Madrid have been linked. I think we're seeing a change in the way the transfer market is structured, and it's now a wage race. Clubs are looking at situations with contracts expiring and saying, maybe it might be better for us to wait 8 to 12 months and make an enormous wage offer. That's what the player wants, that's what the player is interested in, and go for it. My gut would be that he will still be there when the transfer window closes, and obviously Premier League, La Liga, Bundesliga, etc., they can begin talks from January with him, and in that position the transfer fee is removed. Liverpool can maybe stick on a few extra quid in order to get a deal over the line, but Real Madrid will give them some competition for him.
So that's not going to pave the way for Ronaldo to go to PSG then and save him from sitting on the bench even at Juve.
I just think it all kind of ties into the same situation. These things take a lot of work and a lot of pieces to move. And I think in terms of PSG with Mbappe there, if I'm saying that I don't think Mbappe is going to leave, Ronaldo, Messi, Neymar, Di Maria and Mbappe, you can't have that in a team. That would just be completely financially unrealistic. As much as I say PSG can afford these things, if you throw Ronaldo in there, transfer fee and wages, that changes the situation completely. I think his situation at Juventus is quite interesting. They want to keep him because of the player that he is, but he's clearly decided that if there is any sort of a little crack in the window that he can jump through to get out of the club, he will. But I think we are going to see, particularly in the next few days, unless there's a major move somewhere or another, clubs just battening down the hatches, holding players to their contracts, and then letting them see where the land lies in 12 months' time.
So I'm going to go back to Mbappe again. Ruby's probably going to give out to me now. Speculation is intensifying.
That's because you want him in Liverpool, and you're just... Where are you going to play him in Liverpool? Like Salah, Mane, Firmino?
I was going to ask Fergal that. I saw John Aldridge just wrote a column and said that you'll have to get rid of Salah if you want to bring in Mbappe.
I think, again, yeah, there's a way and a way to fit him in. And if Liverpool were to get him, Kylian Mbappe starts, he goes immediately into that team. I think the concern for Liverpool at the moment is Roberto Firmino. I think Diogo Jota has overtaken him as first choice through the middle with Mane and Salah either side. If Mbappe comes in, it changes the structure of the team. And Jurgen Klopp is very much about the system and everyone following the rules that he puts in place. I'm not saying that Mbappe wouldn't, but at PSG he's got a very free license to just go and be Kylian Mbappe. I don't necessarily see him being in that team until Liverpool are in a position to either offload Salah or offload Mane, but at the moment there's no impetus to do that. They're in talks to extend Salah's contract, and that's what I mean. I think there's so many pieces of the jigsaw to fall into place, so many things to have to happen in this kind of chain of events. We've got 7 days to do it. I'm not saying that nobody will move, but for all of these moves to come off in the next 7 days, I think it's pretty unlikely.
So sticking with Mbappe and what I was watching before we came on air, and he's moved to Real Madrid. Ancelotti, obviously he's a fan of Gareth Bale, who's gone for the first time at the weekend. Could we see him playing with Bale? Is that more realistic than Jurgen Klopp having to sell off players he likes?
Yeah, and definitely in the short to medium term. Again, as I say, the situation with contracts, Gareth Bale has another season left on his contract. We know the situation with Real Madrid is very difficult. We know Florentino Perez, the club's president, has wanted to offload him in the past. But the big stumbling block or the big issue in Bale's relationship with Real Madrid has gone, and that's Zinedine Zidane. Him and Carlo Ancelotti have got a really good relationship. He brought him to Real Madrid all those years ago from Spurs. The two seasons that Ancelotti was there were two of Bale's best seasons in La Liga with Real Madrid. They do get on, and Bale is a real good example of a character that if everything is going well, if he feels liked, if he feels loved, if he feels supported, he's still a brilliant player. We see that with Wales because he is so loved by the Wales fans and the management and the squad that they get the best out of him. That obviously wasn't the case under Zidane at Real Madrid. But with Ancelotti, he's a very light touch manager. He doesn't get too involved in these types of things. He won't try and overcoach Bale. He knows the quality that Bale's got. And financially, clubs are having to chase their tails at the moment, particularly in the league with Barcelona and Real Madrid. Financially, it makes more sense. They can't get rid of Gareth Bale. They're going to have to pay his contract. So if they've got him, they might as well play him. Ancelotti looks like he might be able to get a bit of a tune out of him. And then come January, come next year, make the move for Mbappe.
Do you really think he's still a brilliant player? Like, he went back to Spurs where, like, as you said, in Wales, everybody loves him. You'd think that everybody would love him there as well. Like,
if we had him in Ireland, we'd love him too.
Where would you rank him? Like, when it comes to top strikers and the top players in the world and some of them we've mentioned there, like, where does he even fit in there?
Right now, I wouldn't say, no, I mean, I wouldn't have him in the top 10 now in terms of attacking players, definitely not. I think if we're talking about just after when he moved from Spurs, he was definitely right up in that conversation. He is still a very, very good player, but he's a good player now in patches because of his injury situation, because of the sheer lack of football that he's played for so long, because the move to Spurs didn't really work out in terms of him getting games under his belt. He was a bit part role and there was a bit of friction with Jose Mourinho. In terms of Bale, this is what Ancelotti has to manage. He has to realise that he'll get half a dozen games from him, then he'll get a knock. If he gets called up for Wales, he'll go. He might then need to be rested. I don't see him playing 40, 50 games this season. I think we're probably talking more 20 to 30. The onus on Bale and Ancelotti is to make sure that those 20 or 30 games, he makes an impact, or that he plays in the big games to try and get Real Madrid closer to their objectives of winning things. I think his stock has fallen. I think he's definitely way out of the top 10 now, but he's capable of those moments. It's on Ancelotti and on Bale to do that when it matters in the next 12 months.
Moving on to Jose Mourinho, and you're talking about whether people are still capable of doing things. It'll be interesting to see if he's still capable of achieving success as a manager. He did get off to a winning start with victory over Fiorentina, and Tammy Abraham had two assists.
Yeah, and this was a very Mourinho-type game. Lots of controversy, lots of big tackles. There was red cards, there was goals. And he'll relish that type of a situation. That's what he wants. He likes to be the kind of ringmaster within the chaos. But I don't think Jose, he's kind of brief anymore, is anything longer than 18 months to 2 years. I think he will leave his mark on Roma. I think there'll be an immediate little surge in terms of his impact. But we've seen in his last few appointments, United, Spurs, there tends to be a fairly positive start, six to nine months, and then the wheels do start to come off. The concern for Roma is that might happen in the middle of the season, and Abraham is a really good move for him. I think his days were numbered at Chelsea with Romelu Lukaku coming in. Timo Werner is obviously still there. We spoke about him last week. I do rate him. I think he's a very good player. We haven't seen an enormous amount of him to judge whether he's Champions League level striker just yet, but he's still very, very young. He's made a good start. I just hope Mourinho doesn't Mourinho him and ruin him, because he seems like a really positive character and a good player, and they don't tend to gel well with Mourinho.
Fergal, just before we let you go, Denmark's captain Simon Kjær and the medical team that saved Christian Eriksen's life are the recipients of this year's UEFA's President's Award, a fitting tribute for what they did at the European Championships.
Absolutely. I mean, everyone remembers that game. Everyone remembers whether they were watching it or the news was filtering through on Twitter or whatever. And it was a horrible, horrible few hours where football just completely flew out the window. And the only concern was for Christian Eriksen and his health. And the reaction of Simon Kjær, the players, and obviously the medical staff who were there, like, that has kind of been maybe undersold a little bit, was absolutely incredible. The quick thinking of everybody involved saved Christian Eriksen's life. And medical staff at football grounds, sometimes they don't really have a lot to do. They have the unfortunate job of only kind of springing into action when there's a major emergency, but their response was absolutely unreal. And Christian Eriksen now is thankfully back healthy. There's still obviously conversations to be had about whether he'll be able to be registered and what is next for his career, but a brilliant tribute to people that are involved that no doubt saved his life.
Fergal, we spoke last night to Stephen Kelly and Alan Cawley about Jack Byrne's situation with Apoel and the fact that he looks like he is going to be leaving the club. Any suggestion or idea of where he's going to go in the short term anyway?
There's been speculation that he'll come to England, to the Championship, that he'll get a short-term loan and then possibly look to join the MLS in 2022. There's talk of Hull, Middlesbrough and one or two others in the Championship. This is a deal that I could see getting done. We've seen in bits and pieces, obviously, his time with Shamrock and now a little bit with Apoel. It's obviously difficult to kind of gauge exactly how he's getting on. But he's a very, very good player. If he comes to the Championship and he tears it up and he makes an impact, he might have second thoughts about going to America. Club who loans him might have second thoughts about keeping him. Because if everything clicks into place with Jack, he is very, very, very talented. He still wants to be involved with Ireland. He wants to be a force. Probably if things fall his way, he would like to get back to being a Premier League player. This is an opportunity for him. He has to make the right choice. He has to pick the right club. It can't just be a kind of last gasp decision of they're offering a return, they're offering a contract, I'll go. He has to make the right call, because this is a really important turning point in his career.
Thank you, Fergal Brennan. We'll be back after these ads.
Dinners made easy with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets range, available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now, the situation in Afghanistan has been concerning for many reasons, but particularly the plight of women and girls. A little bit earlier, the Australian government evacuated more than 50 women footballers and athletes and their dependents from Afghanistan following an appeal by world bodies FIFA and FIFPro. And to talk us through events leading to this, I'm delighted to say that women's football writer Susie Rack from The Guardian joins us now. Susie, it's been a really harrowing few days for everybody over there and for people sitting at home and watching events unfold. How did they get to a situation where they were able to evacuate these women footballers and athletes?
Hi both. It's been a really Herculean effort on the part of quite a small group of people who have called on a much sort of wider stream of connections to make this happen. There's still a very long way to go. They've got 75 on a plane, hopefully headed to Australia. But there's still, you know, plenty of female athletes who are at huge risk and need help. So it's very far from over. But there's, you know, obviously having gone from nothing to getting 75 out within the last 24 hours is hugely significant. These women were, you know, real champions of equality in the country. Their involvement in sport and, you know, not just football, in all kinds of different sports, really directly challenged Taliban ideology. And they all very much were encouraged to use their position as sports stars to raise the profile of equality campaigning and to use the position they had to help build a sort of new, better Afghanistan. And so, you know, we all sort of owe them a gratitude and duty. We have a duty of care, I think, as a society generally in the world, to look after these women and get them to safety. And yeah, like I say, really small group, absolutely incredible effort that's gone on behind the scenes, led by Khalida Popal, who was involved in exposing the sexual abuse case against the president of the Afghanistan Football Federation over his abuse of players on the women's national team a couple of years ago, has again like played this absolutely incredible role in coordinating the effort to get the girls to safety. I mean, I literally cannot say I've met a more incredible woman alongside Kelly Lindsay and Hayley Carter, who were the coach and assistant coach of the team, who have, you know, basically all been working 24 hours, barely sleeping, taking sort of strategic naps, for want of a better way of putting it, to sort of get through and make sure that they're in constant contact across multiple time zones. So yeah, hugely significant development, but, you know, still a lot more to do and a lot of support needed to you know, help more female athletes in the country.
It's all a bit surreal, really, Susie, when you think about it, and when you read it and watch and you're hearing reports on the news. But can you just give us a bit of context on maybe just how much danger were these women in?
Yeah, so they had basically put their lives on the line to be able to be involved in sport in the first place, despite, you know, the country not having been under Taliban rule. Obviously, the Taliban haven't just sprung out of nowhere. They've been gradually, you know, kind of winning areas of the country for a very long time. And, you know, they have always had some kind of presence. And their ideology as well hasn't just gone away. You know, these women have been operating and trying to play football in very, very different circumstances. So all of their international games took place abroad, their home games too. All of their training camps took place abroad. You know, it's very difficult for them to play in Afghanistan in non-Taliban times. And they've all spoken out and been very public and really used the profile that they've had playing sport to challenge Taliban ideology and fight for equality of women in the country. And yeah, I mean, hugely brave of them to do that. You know, they've faced physical abuse, they faced verbal abuse on a regular basis for playing. They obviously have faced sexual abuse as well, as you know, we exposed a couple of years ago from people within the federation itself, and have fought on in the name of quality. You know, they stepped onto a pitch because of a love of the game, but they found their sort of political voices on the pitch as well. And that puts them at risk, because in the same way journalists and you know, sort of human rights activists and stuff are at risk in the country, they've used football for that type of cause. So yeah, extreme danger. Lots of them in getting to the airport faced beatings, had to you know, avoid gunfire and things. You know, it'd be extremely difficult. I can't go into a load of detail because obviously there's still a lot of risks involved in getting more out and whether that's possible. And so, you know, we can't really discuss too much about the methods that have been used to help get these women out of the country. But yeah, again, just a absolutely Herculean effort from a very, very small group of people to bring these women to a safety, although, you know, they've, some of them are extremely young, their lives are completely up in the air, they need to find asylum in certain countries, they need to get settled. You know, it's a story that is far, far from over.
And Susie, the Taliban have been out of power since 2001 in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. A lot of the girls that are now almost on their own don't really remember what life was like when the Taliban were there.
Yeah, no, that's very true. You know, it's a for one of the better ways of putting it, in that, you know, they've got the legacy of the Taliban regime sort of, you know, through secondhand sources, through parents, through teammates like Khalida, who is and Shabnam, former captain of the team. Their players were sort of were babies in the sort of last round of Taliban rule, and, you know, can really understand and relate.
But I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Susie, because the line has gone. But we all definitely echo your sentiments and thoughts there. An absolutely amazing effort from so many people to get those women and girls out of Afghanistan. And as Susie says, there is still an awful lot to do. It is still a very volatile situation, and we just hope that everybody else gets out safely. We're going to take a very quick break.
With Green Firm. Naturally good food packed with protein.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back, and for anyone who is just joining us, we spoke to Susie Rack there a few minutes ago about the plight of the women's footballers in Afghanistan. There was a little bit of good news for some of them. More than 50 have been evacuated and they are on the way to Australia, where they will hopefully be safe. But Susie outlined that there is still a huge amount to be done and a lot more to get out. It was pretty harrowing, and it's been, I think, just a terrible, terrible time for everybody there and for anyone that is connected to the women in Afghanistan, because I think that the reality is that it is going to get a huge amount worse for women, that the Taliban, although they're saying that they have softened their approach and their attitudes to women, I'd be very surprised if it is that case, especially when you're reading things like former coaches like Hayley Carter, she was an assistant coach for the Afghanistan women's national team, begging people to stop sharing photographs of women footballers on social media. She has also said that the women should burn their jerseys, their photos, anything that will connect them to playing football. It's just really, really frightening to even think about these women having to hide just because they went out and played a game, just because they did something that they loved.
Marie, it's an ideology that is alien to everybody, I hope, in the Western world, and you can only feel sorry for them. It's a huge step backwards, you would have to think, the way we see things, and you do feel extremely sorry for them, and you hope as many of them can get out of Afghanistan as quickly and as safely as possible. It's a very sad and stressful situation for a lot of people, but we have to keep moving forward, and joining us on the line is Johnny Murta. Johnny, you had a plan for a long time with a horse called Sonny Boy Liston, and it certainly came to fruition last Saturday on the Knaresmire.
It did, and thankfully it did, because, you know, you make a lot of plans with these horses and you have great ideas at the start of the year, and not all of them come off, but it worked out with Treat. You know, he rocked up there in good form. He had a couple of good runs during the year. He won a listed race. You know, it was a big pot. You know, it was £500,000 race. So he had him in good form going there, very competitive race, but Ben Cohen gave him a great ride, and we came out on the right end of a very tight finish.
We'll get to Ben in a minute, but Johnny, the Ebor is intertwined, I suppose, with the Melbourne Cup, and have you any plans to bring Sonny Boy Liston down there? I know Miran is owned by OTI, who's an Australian ownership. He's going to go your other horse, but would you contemplate bringing Sonny Boy down?
if it was a normal year and everybody could travel and we could all get down there, I would be going down there in a heartbeat. You know what I mean? It's a great race. It's a huge, you know, it's huge in Australia. It's after catching the imagination of all of us here in Europe. Great prize money. It's a handicap. You know, horse that runs well or wins the Ebor goes down there with, you know, good credentials, big handicap, hustle and bustle. You know, we like to think he'll hold his form going down there. But, you know, yeah, just getting down there at the moment, for the people involved, for my staff and myself, you know, 2 weeks in quarantine, they have to go a month before they get going. It's just not straightforward. It's something we have to think about. And now the Melbourne Cup has got, you know, very stringent rules about getting horses down there. So he has to go into a... He has to do a lot of tests, like abnormal amount of tests to get down there. He has to pass them. And then he has to go down there and train for 2 weeks before the race. So it's not just ideal. So it's you'd love to be going.
It's $5 million Australian dollars, Johnny.
That's not all about the money, Robbie. It's not, it can't be always about the money.
Well, look, you didn't win it as a jockey, so you're going to have to try and win it as a trainer.
Yeah, but you're just, it's not like I'm only starting out in my training career. If I don't win it this year, there's a good chance I might win it next year or the year after that. So that's the way I'm thinking of it. But it's hard to get down there. It's hard to pass the test. I haven't spoken to all the owners yet, you know, and there's a few offers in the pipeline. So it's just a little bit up in the air. But I just wish it was 2 years ago where we just hopped on a plane and flew down there and trained the horse out myself. You know, you have to be around them and see how they are and train them.
Johnny, I was listening to you being interviewed a little while ago and talking about decisions that you make and how you're able to draw on your experience as a jockey. And I suppose one thing a lot of people have learned is just because you're good as a player doesn't mean that you're going to be good as a coach or a trainer. But you seem to be someone that has been able to do both. How much do you think it has benefited you?
Well, I love that, because the more people see you can't do those things, that really drives me on. You know, I'm kind of that kind of person. But yeah, you know, they say top flat jockeys never make good trainers. We don't have patience, or we don't have this, or we don't have that. But yeah, I have been riding a lot of these big races. I have rode all the tracks in Ireland, and you know, sometimes you just get a feel for your own horse and you say, yeah, he liked Navan, or he liked the Corral, he liked a tight track down in Ballinrobe or Bellistown. Yeah, I think it's helped me, and I was always a team player, so now I'm the manager of the team, so it's all about the team with me, keeping the team happy, keeping them motivated. We're all on the one wavelength. We all want the one goal, and as I said, I'm really enjoying it. Now, you can say it's easy to enjoy it when the horses run well, which is true, but from day one, I don't have the sacrifices of a jockey. Like, when I was a jockey, I was watching me weigh 24/7. I couldn't eat. I was narky. I was bit grouchy. I couldn't, you know, it wasn't a normal kind of life, where now I'm kind of having a normal life, spending time with my family. I'm going to watch them play football, so I'm a bit more relaxed, and I just love what I'm doing.
Johnny, you were at Champions Weekend maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago, having lunch, and you said to Orla, I want a horse here, this is where we need to be. You've got yourself there. You had the winner at Champions Weekend last year. This year, you're the winner at Royal Ascot with Crepe Belief. You went to Goodwill with Ottoman Empire. You're achieving what you want to achieve. What's next?
Well, it's always progression. You know, I want to just be there on a regular basis. I want my horse to run very consistently well. You know, I didn't really always have that in my life. I was kind of up and I was down. So I just want to be nice and consistent. My horse is nice and consistent. I train a lot of nice horses for nice people, which is good too. You know what I mean? They kind of give me free rein and they let me at it, and that's huge. You know, like I just said to them at the start, if you don't trust me with the horse, just don't give them to me in the first place. But don't give them to me and then say, oh, I'll tell you where to run them and I'll tell you what to do with them, because I don't feed well off that. I like them when they trust me and say, you just go out there, do your thing. Now you have to get the results at the end of the day when they do that to you. But I think we are now. We're in a position now where people are trusting us, and they're giving us better horses, and they know that we can show up on the big day and we can produce these horses, you know, to run their best.
You wanted to be trusted, and listening to you speaking after you won the Ebor the other day, you have great trust in your team and in your jockey Ben Cohen. He's only 19. It takes a lot of courage to put that much trust in such a young jockey.
Well, Ruby, that was last week. He's after getting two bollockings off me from getting beaten on two favourites in Bellion Town tonight. So it doesn't last very long, this trust. But no, listen, Ruby, you know as a jockey, there's nothing better when your trainer has your back. The trainer has your back. He trusts you. He, listen, Ben rides out the horses there 6 days a week. He knows all the horses now, like all the jockeys. I put all my jockeys on them because they work hard and they know our horses and they know me and they know the way we like to have them ridden. Now, I give them chances, but if they don't take the chances, there's a good chance they won't be riding them the next time. So I'd like to think I'm fair. I'm tough, but fair on them. But Ben Cohen, what can I say? Like, he's 19. He's very cool. He's very calm. And that's what you need on the big day. You don't need getting a bit nervous on the big day or a bit jittery. The horses all sense that. I always felt the bigger the day, the more relaxed you had to be. And I'd have to say that to myself. And I mightn't be that relaxed inside, but on the outside, I had to look like I was relaxed, I was in control. And then everybody around you, the owners in the parade ring, the staff that's with you, and the horses themselves, sense that off you, and they're a bit more relaxed. Because you know, in those big days, it's a split second. Do I go left or do I go right? And you go from being the hero to the zero very, very quickly.
Ruby was complimenting you last night on the show, actually. He was saying that it was really nice to hear you coming out and speaking about Ben Cohen and just the fact that you have his back and that, you know, despite maybe everything that's going on and just how difficult it is for young people and young sports people, the abuse that they might get on social media, that it almost gives you a little bit of security when you hear somebody like you, who is your boss, the coach of the team, coming out and saying that you have their back.
Yeah, but it's terrible what goes on social media, you know, like I try not to pay much attention to it, you know, so I don't get too high on the good stuff and I don't get too low on the negative stuff, but it's terrible that some people can say those things to other people, to young jockeys or to young soccer players, to young sports people that's not after having a good day, that's probably gone out there to try and do their best and something has happened that it went wrong for them, and anybody can make a mistake. And sure, if he doesn't get the trust from me, you know, he'd be left there, he'd be lost. And you know, I think young people nowadays, they need that. They need the reassurance. Sometimes I feel they're a bit negative towards themselves. So I don't have to keep telling them how good they are. You know, you're 19. You're great. You're the man. I want you. And the young people in general need to hear that, because they have a little bit of negativity towards themselves. In general, they start off with that. So if they start off with that and then they read a couple of texts, they start believing that shit then. So it's you know, they need a bit of positivity around them, and if I'm not going to give it to them, well then I don't think I'll be much of a boss.
Johnny, at being his boss, you also spoke about good horses helping him develop, but you also spoke about how Australia helped you develop as a rider. Could you see yourself sending Ben or advising Ben to go somewhere for a winter to get himself to be the next Johnny Murta, the next Mick Kinnan, the next Pat Smullen? Would you contemplate that?
It is. It's definitely gives you a different outlook. It's getting harder to get into these places, but 3 months away, watching good jockeys or different jockeys do these different things, that really opened my eyes. You know, in Australia, it's very the races start very quick, and all the good positions are gone. Like you can't just decide after two furlongs, oh, I want a good position. Like, the good positions are all gone by the good jockeys after 100 yards. So that's what one thing I found out. I said, right, I need to be on the ball here. It sharpened me up mentally. It got me to see it, you know, to open my mind the way other jockeys ride. But I had great mentors here when I started. There was Christy Roach, there was Mick Kinnan, Stephen Crane, Pat Shannon. They would have held their own anywhere in the world. But it would be good for Ben to go either America or Australia, Hong Kong, Dubai, and see all these other great jockeys, international jockeys, see how they ride,
and pick up, if you can pick up one little thing and add it to your armour. That's what I used to do every year. I said, I have to keep adding something. I knew I was a good rider, but I said, I have to keep adding something every year or I'll become predictable and they'll know what I like. So I had to say to myself, something extra every year to kind of keep me ahead of the lads that are coming, who are probably, they're hungry. So that's what I always keep saying to Ben. I says, you have to keep improving, you know, do something better every day. I says, don't be predictable, don't be going out there. And like when I was riding, I could see other jockeys, I'd nearly say, well, he'll do this and he'll do that. The great jockeys, you don't know what they're going to do. They're the lads that are hard to beat, because you don't know what to, so you can't be too predictable. You have to have, you know, a variety of stuff in your locker. That's what makes you, from, I said to Ben, do you want to be good or do you want to be great? And it's up to him then to decide.
Well, I hope he's great and you're making a great fist out of training. And Johnny Murta, thanks a million for taking our call this evening. Best of luck for Irish Champions Weekend, which comes up at the weekend of the 11th and 12th of September.